And that's what we call one way to mix out. This has been The Buffer on WRCT Pittsburgh. Have a good evening, everyone. .org.
Are you a dementia caregiver? Perhaps you care for your spouse, family member, or friend. Whoever it is, being a dementia caregiver can build relationships and test them. I'm Bill, and I want to thank you for the care you have provided. I have faced similar situations, so I'm speaking on behalf of the Dementia Society of America, a nonprofit organization. Request our free guide filled with tips on care, planning, and much more. Go to 1-800-DEMENTIA.org or call 1-800-DEMENTIA. Thank you.
Hello, I'm Dr. Ruth Westheimer, and if you listen to WRCT Pittsburgh, you know that in most cases, size does not matter.
Say my love for you ain't real. But you don't know how real it feels. All I want to spend some time with you so I can hold you, hold you. Your sister says that I'm no good. I'd reassure
You are listening to WRCT 88.3 in Pittsburgh, and this is...
Here on WRCT Pittsburgh, 88.3 FM, and on WRCT.org. I'm your host, Camomile, and today I'll be reading you a story. This week, we'll be reading some sci-fi. These stories may not be as appropriate for those younger folks in the audience, and may be a touch unsettling, but nonetheless, I think they'll be a treat. Up first, we'll have To Be or Not to Be by Kurt Vonnegut. We have The Eyes Have It by Philip K. Dick. And Watchbird by Robert Sheckley. As always, you can email sideways.radio@gmail.com if you have a story you'd like me to read on Monday nights, here on the radio. My only requirement, that it needs to be in the U.S. public domain, which usually means published 1931 or earlier, or in this case, the author just allowed the work to be put into the public domain. Before we get into the story, though, I need to let you know some goings-on in the city of Pittsburgh with the radio and music calendar. If you or your organization would like an event included in the WRCT radio calendar, please send the details at least 2 weeks in advance to radio-calendar@wrct.org. The Pittsburgh Indie Expo, or PIE for short, will be hosted at the Heinz History Center on Sunday, March 15th. PIE is a free, volunteer-run, all-ages festival dedicated to showcasing the vibrant world of independent comics, zines, small press publishing, and DIY creative work. The Indie Expo features a curated exhibitor floor with exhibitors from the local scene and far beyond, professional artist panels, hands-on workshops, and interactive programming designed to inspire makers and fans alike. Hosted at the Heinz History Center, the festival also offers attendees free access to museum exhibits, creating an immersive cultural experience in the heart of Pittsburgh. Read more at pieburg.com. Also, here are a couple free museums around Pittsburgh you may not have heard about. The Frick is a cluster of museums and historical buildings located in the Point Breeze neighborhood around the Frick family's 19th century residence known as Clayton. Admission is free to the gardens, the permanent collection of the Frick Museum, and the Car and Carriage Museum, but paid tickets are required for tours of Clayton, temporary exhibitions, and other special events. Tickets may be reserved at thefrickpittsburgh.org. Also, the Troy Hill Art Houses are a collection of four houses on Pittsburgh's north side, transformed by the visions of individual artists. There is no cost associated with visiting the art houses, and they consider your visit as that of an honored guest in a private home. Children under the age of 15 are not permitted into those installations, and photography is not permitted inside. They're only open by appointment. More information is at troyhillarthouses.com. That was the radio calendar, and now we move on to the music calendar. If you represent a Pittsburgh-related musician, band, or venue and would like us to list your events in our music calendar, please send an email with all the details, being date, time, place, and performers, to music-calendar@wrct.org. The calendar is updated each week on Wednesday afternoon. This Thursday, March 12th, at 8 p.m., at the Roboto Project, there's Disney Killed the Everglades, Buy Her Candy, Friends for Sale, and You Should Have Brought Me Flowers. At Spirit Hall this Friday, at 7 p.m., there's Sweet Pill with Heart to Gold and Spaced. And Saturday, March 14th, at 6:30 p.m. at Stage AE is Andrew Callahan. Also, at 9 p.m. at Spirit Hall, there's Moist Breezy with Paula Jean, Lemon Line, Toss Kitty, and Lefty. That was the WRCT radio and music calendar. Let's get into the reading. Got a problem? Just pick up the phone. It solved them all, and all the same way. To be or not to be. By Kurt Vonnegut Jr. Everything was perfectly swell. There were no prisons, no slums, no insane asylums, no poverty, no wars. All diseases were conquered. So was old age. Death, barring accidents, was an adventure for volunteers. The population of the United States was stabilized at 40 million souls. One bright morning in the Chicago Lying-In Hospital, a man named Edward K. Welling Jr. waited for his wife to give birth. He was the only man waiting. Not many people were born a day anymore. Welling was 56, a mere stripling in a population whose average age was 129. X-rays had revealed that his wife was going to have triplets. The children would be his first. Young Welling was hunched in his chair, his head in his hand. He was so rumpled, so still and colorless as to be virtually invisible. His camouflage was perfect, since the waiting room had a disorderly and demoralized air, too. Chairs and ashtrays had been moved away from the walls. The floor was paved with spattered drop cloths. The room was being redecorated. It was being redecorated as a memorial to a man who had volunteered to die. A sardonic old man, about 200 years old, sat on a stepladder, painting a mural he did not like. Back in the days when people aged visibly, his age would have been guessed at 35 or so. Aging had touched him that much before the cure for aging was found. The mural he was working on depicted a very neat garden. Men and women in white, doctors and nurses, turned the soil, planted seedlings, sprayed bugs, spread fertilizer. Men and women in purple uniforms pulled up weeds, cut down plants that were old and sickly, raked leaves, carried refuse to trash burners. Never, 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 not even in medieval Holland nor old Japan, had a garden been more formal, been better tended. Every plant had all the loam, light, water, air, and nourishment it could use. A hospital orderly came down the corridor, singing under his breath a popular song. If you don't like my kisses, honey, here is what I'll do. I'll go see a girl in purple, kiss this sad world, toodaloo. If you don't want my lovin', why should I take up all this space? I'll get off this old planet, let some sweet baby have my place. The orderly looked in at the mural and the muralist. Looks so real, he said. I can practically imagine I'm standing in the middle of it. What makes you think you're not in it? Said the painter. He gave a satiric smile. It's called the Happy Garden of Life, you know. That's good of Dr. Hitz, said the orderly. He was referring to one of the male figures in white, whose head was a portrait of Dr. Benjamin Hitz, the hospital's chief obstetrician. Hitz was a blindingly handsome man. Lots of faces still to fill in, said the orderly. He meant that the faces of many of the figures in the mural were still blank. All blanks were to be filled with portraits of important people on either the hospital staff or from the Chicago office of the Federal Bureau of Termination. Must be nice to be able to make pictures that look like something, said the orderly. The painter's face curled with scorn. You think I'm proud of this dog? He said. You think this is my idea of what life really looks like? What's your idea of what life looks like? Said the orderly. The painter gestured at a foul drop cloth. There's a good picture of it, he said. Frame that, and you'll have a picture a damn sight more honest than this one. You're a gloomy old duck, aren't you? Said the orderly. Is that a crime? Said the painter. The orderly shrugged. If you don't like it here, Grandpa, he said, and he finished the thought with the trick telephone number that people who didn't want to live anymore were supposed to call. The zero in the telephone number he pronounced not. The number was 2BR0 2B. It was the telephone number of an institution whose fanciful sobriquets included Automat, Birdland, Cannery, Catbox, Delouser, Easy Go, Goodbye, Mother, Happy Hooligan, Kiss Me Quick, Lucky Pierre, Sheep Dip, Wearing Blender, Weep No More, and Why Worry? To Be or Not To Be was the telephone number of the municipal gas chambers of the Federal Bureau of Termination. The painter thumbed his nose at the orderly. When I decide it's time to go, he said, it won't be at the Sheep Dip. Ah, do-it-yourselfer, eh? Said the orderly. Messy business, Grandpa. Why don't you have a little consideration for the people who have to clean up after you? The painter expressed, with an obscenity, his lack of concern for the tribulations of his survivors. The world could do with a good deal more mess, if you ask me, he said. The orderly laughed and moved on. Welling, the waiting father, mumbled something without raising his head, and then he fell silent again. A coarse, formidable woman strode into the waiting room on spike heels. Her shoes, stockings, trench coat, bag, and overseas cap were all purple, the purple the painter called the color of grapes on Judgment Day. The medallion on her purple musette bag was the seal of the service division of the Federal Bureau of Termination, an eagle perched upon a turnstile. The woman had a lot of facial hair, an unmistakable mustache, in fact. Curious thing about gas chamber hostesses was that, no matter how lovely and feminine they were when they were recruited, they all sprouted mustaches within 5 years or so. "Is this where I'm supposed to come?" she said to the painter. "A lot would depend on what your business was," he said. "You aren't about to have a baby, are you?" "They told me I was supposed to pose for some picture," she said. "My name's Leora Duncan." She waited. "And you dunk people," he said. "What?" she said. "Skip it," he said. "That sure is a beautiful picture," she said. "Looks just like heaven or something." "Or something," said the painter. He took a list of names from his smock pocket. "Duncan, Duncan, Duncan," he said, scanning the list. "Yes, here you are. You're entitled to be immortalized. See any faceless body here you'd like me to stick your head on? You've got a few choice ones left." She studied the mural bleakly. "Gee," she said. "They're all the same to me. I don't know anything about art." "A body's a body, eh?" he said. "Alrighty. As a master of fine art, I recommend this body here." He indicated a faceless figure of a woman who carried dried stalks to a trash burner. "Well," said Leora Duncan, "that's more the disposal people, isn't it? I mean, I'm in service. I don't do any disposing." The painter clapped his hands in mock delight. "You say you don't know anything about art, and then you prove in the next breath that you know more about it than I do. Of course the sheave carrier is wrong for a hostess. A snipper, a pruner, that's more your line." He pointed to a figure in purple who was sawing a dead branch from an apple tree. "How about her?" he said. "You like her at all?" "Gosh," she said. She blushed and became humble. That puts me right next to Dr. Hitz." "That upsets you?" he said. "Good gravy, no," she said. It's just such an honor." "Ah, you admire him, eh?" he said. "Who doesn't admire him?" she said, worshipping the portrait of Hitz. It was the portrait of a tanned, white-haired, omnipotent Seuss, 240 years old. "Who doesn't admire him?" she said again. "He was responsible for setting up the very first gas chamber in Chicago." "Nothing would please me more," said the painter, "to put you next to him for all time. Sawing off a limb. That strikes you as appropriate?" "That is kind of what I like to do," she said. She was very demure about what she did. What she did was make people comfortable while she killed them. And, while Leora Duncan was posing for her portrait, into the waiting room bounded Dr. Hitz himself. He was 7 feet tall, and he boomed with importance, accomplishments, and the joy of living. "Well, Miss Duncan, Miss Duncan," he said, and he made a joke. "What are you doing here?" he said. "This isn't where the people leave. This is where they come in." "We're going to be in the same picture together," she said shyly. "Good," said Dr. Hitz heartily. "And say, isn't that some picture?" "I sure am honored to be in it with you," she said. "Let me tell you," he said, "I'm honored to be in it with you. Without women like you, this wonderful world we've got wouldn't be possible." He saluted her and moved toward the door that led to the delivery rooms. "Guess what was just born," he said. "I can't," she said. "Triplets," he said. "Triplets," she said. She was exclaiming over the legal implications of triplets. The law said that no newborn child could survive unless the parents of the child could find someone who would volunteer to die. Triplets, if they were all to live, called for 3 volunteers. "Do the parents have 3 volunteers?" said Leora Duncan. "Last I heard," said Dr. Hitz, "they had 1 and were trying to scrape another 2 up." "I don't think they made it," she said. "Nobody made 3 appointments with us. Nothing but singles going through today, unless somebody called in after I left. What's the name? Welling, said the waiting father, sitting up, red-eyed and frowsy. Edward K. Welling, Jr. is the name of the happy father-to-be. He raised his right hand, looked at a spot on the wall, gave a hoarsely wretched chuckle. Present, he said. Oh, Mr. Welling, said Dr. Hitz, I didn't see you. The invisible man, said Welling. They just phoned me that your triplets have been born, said Dr. Hitz. They're all fine, and so is the mother. I'm on my way in to see them now. Hooray, said Welling, emptily. You don't sound very happy, said Dr. Hitz. What man in my shoes wouldn't be happy, said Welling. He gestured with his hands to symbolize carefree simplicity. All I have to do is pick out which one of the triplets is going to live, then deliver my maternal grandfather to the happy hooligan and come back here with a receipt. Dr. Hitz became rather severe with Welling, towered over him. You don't believe in population control, Mr. Welling, he said. I think it's perfectly keen, said Welling tautly. Would you like to go back to the good old days when the population of the Earth was 20 billion? Have to become 40 billion, then 80 billion, then 160 billion? Do you know what a druplet is, Mr. Welling? Said Hitz. No, said Welling sulkily. A druplet, Mr. Welling, is one of the little knobs, one of the little pulpy grains of a blackberry, said Dr. Hitz. Without population control, human beings would now be packed on the surface of this old planet like druplets on a blackberry. Think of it. Welling continued to stare at the same spot on the wall. In the year 2000, said Dr. Hitz, before scientists stepped in and laid down the law, there wasn't even enough drinking water to go around and nothing to eat but seaweed. And still, people insisted on their right to reproduce like jackrabbits. And their right, if possible, to live forever. I want those kids, said Welling quietly. I want all three of them. Of course you do, said Dr. Hitz. That's only human.
I don't want my grandfather to die either, said Welling.
Nobody's really happy about taking a close relative to the cat box, said Dr. Hitz, gently, sympathetically.
I wish people wouldn't call it that, said Leora Duncan.
What? Said Dr. Hitz.
I wish people wouldn't call it the cat box and things like that, she said. It gives people the wrong impression.
You're absolutely right, said Dr. Hitz. Forgive me. He corrected himself, gave the municipal gas chambers their official title, a title no one ever used in conversation. I should have said, Ethical Suicide Studios, he said.
That sounds so much better, said Leora Duncan.
This child of yours, whichever one you decide to keep, Mr. Welling, said Dr. Hitz, he or she is going to live on a happy, roomy, clean, rich planet thanks to population control. In a garden like that mural there. He shook his head. 2 centuries ago, when I was a young man, it was a hell that nobody thought could last another 20 years. Now centuries of peace and plenty stretch before us as far as the imagination cares to travel. He smiled luminously. The smile faded as he saw that Welling had just drawn a revolver. Welling shot Dr. Hitz dead. There's room for one, a great big one, he said. And then he shot Leora Duncan. It's only death, he said to her as she fell. There, room for two. And then he shot himself, making room for all three of his children. Nobody came running. Nobody, seemingly, heard the shots. The painter sat on top of his stepladder, looking down reflectively on the sorry scene.
The painter pondered the mournful puzzle of life, demanding to be born, and once born, demanding to be fruitful, to multiply and to live as long as possible, to do all that on a very small planet that would have to last forever. All the answers that the painter could think of were grim. Even grimmer, surely, than a cat box, a happy hooligan, an easy go. He thought of war. He thought of plague. He thought of starvation. He knew that he would never paint again. He let his paintbrush fall to the drop cloths below, and then he decided he had had about enough of life in the happy garden of life, too. Then he came slowly down from the ladder. He took Welling's pistol, really intending to shoot himself. But he didn't have the nerve. And then he saw the telephone booth in the corner of the room. He went to it, dialed the well-remembered number, 2BR, not 2B. "Federal Bureau of Termination," said the very warm voice of a hostess. "How soon could I get an appointment?" he asked, speaking very carefully. "I can probably fit you in late this afternoon, sir," she said. "It might even be earlier if we get a cancellation." "All right," said the painter. "Fit me in, if you please." And he gave her his name, spelling it out. "Thank you, sir," said the hostess. "Your city thanks you, your country thanks you, your planet thanks you. But the deepest thanks of all is from future generations." The end. Apologies that that may have been a little bit more unsettling than other bedtime stories I have read on the radio, but up next is something a little bit lighter, pretty short. It's The Eyes Have It by Philip K. Dick. It was quite by accident I discovered this incredible invasion of Earth by life forms from another planet. As yet, I haven't done anything about it. I can't think of anything to do. I wrote to the government, and they sent back a pamphlet on the repair and maintenance of frame houses. Anyhow, the whole thing is known. I'm not the first to discover it. Maybe it's even under control. I was sitting in my easy chair, idly turning the pages of a paper-backed book someone had left on the bus, when I came across the reference that first put me on the trail. For a moment, I didn't respond. It took some time for the full import to sink in. After I'd comprehended, it seemed odd I hadn't noticed it right away. The reference was clearly to a non-human species of incredible properties, not indigenous to Earth. A species, I hasten to point out, customarily masquerading as ordinary human beings. Their disguise, however, became transparent in the face of the following observations by the author. It was at once obvious the author knew everything, and was taking it in his stride. The line, and I tremble remembering it even now, read, "His eyes slowly roved about the room." Vague chills assailed me. I tried to picture the eyes. Did they roll like dimes? The passage indicated not. They seemed to move through the air, not over the surface. Rather rapidly, apparently. No one in the story was surprised. That's what tipped me off. No sign of amazement at such an outrageous thing. Later, the matter was amplified. His eyes moved from person to person. There it was, in a nutshell. The eyes had clearly come apart from the rest of him and were on their own. My heart pounded, and my breath choked in my windpipe. I had stumbled on an accidental mention of a totally unfamiliar race, obviously non-terrestrial. Yet, to the characters in the book, it was perfectly natural, which suggested they belonged to the same species. And the author? A slow suspicion burned in my mind. The author was taking it rather too easily in his stride. Evidently, he felt this was quite a usual thing. He made absolutely no attempt to conceal this knowledge. The story continued. Presently, his eyes fastened on Julia. Julia, being a lady, had at least the nature to feel indignant. She's described as blushing and knitting her brows angrily. At this, I sighed with relief. they weren't all non-terrestrials. Their narrative continues, slowly, calmly, his eyes examined every inch of her. Great Scott. But here the girl turned and stomped off, and the matter ended. I lay back in my chair, gasping with horror. My wife and family regarded me in wonder. What's wrong, dear? My wife asked. I couldn't tell her. Knowledge like this was too much for the ordinary run-of-the-mill person. I had to keep it to myself. Nothing, I gasped. I leaped up, snatched the book, and hurried out of the room. In the garage, I continued reading. There was more. Trembling, I read the next revealing passage. He put his arm around Julia. Presently, she asked him if he would remove his arm. He immediately did so, with a smile. It's not said what was done with the arm after the fellow had removed it. Maybe it was left standing upright in the corner. Maybe it was thrown away. I don't care. In any case, the full meaning was there, staring me right in the face. Here was a race of creatures, capable of removing portions of their anatomy at will. Eyes, arms, and maybe more. Without batting an eyelash. My knowledge of biology came in handy at this point. Obviously, they were simple beings, unicellular, some sort of primitive single-celled things. Beings no more developed than starfish. Starfish can do the same thing, you know. I read on, and came to this incredible revelation, tossed off coolly by the author without the faintest tremor. Outside the movie theater, we split up. Part of us went inside, part over to the cafe for dinner. Binary fission, obviously. Splitting in half and forming two entities, probably each lower half went to the cafe, it being farther, and the upper half to the movies. I read on, hands shaking. I really stumbled onto something here. My mind reeled as I made out this passage. I'm afraid there's no doubt about it. Poor Bibney has lost his head again. Which was followed by, and Bob says he has utterly no guts. Yet Bibney got around as well as the next person. The next person, however, was just as strange. He was soon described as totally lacking in brains. There is no doubt of the thing in the next passage. Julia, whom I had thought to be the one normal person, reveals herself as also being an alien life form, similar to the rest. Quite deliberately, Julia had given her heart to the young man. I didn't relate what the final disposition of the organ was, but I didn't really care. It was evident Julia had gone right on living in her usual manner, like all the others in the book. Without heart, arms, eyes, brains, viscera, dividing up in two when the occasion demanded, without a qualm. Thereupon, she gave him her hand. I sickened. The rascal now had her hand as well as her heart. I shudder to think what he's done with them by this time. He took her arm. Not content to wait, he had to start dismantling her on his own. Flushing crimson, I slammed the book shut and leaped to my feet. But not in time to escape one last reference to the carefree bits of anatomy whose travels had originally thrown me on the track. Her eyes followed him all the way down the road and across the meadow. I rushed from the garage and back inside the warm house, as if the accursed things were following me. My wife and children were playing Monopoly in the kitchen. I joined them and played with frantic fervor. Brow feverish, teeth chattering. I had had enough of the thing. I wanted to hear no more about it. Let them come on. Let them invade Earth. I don't want to get mixed up in it. I have absolutely no stomach for it. That was The Eyes Have It by Philip Dick. Up next we have Watchbird by Robert Sheckley. This is an excerpt from Galaxy Science Fiction from February 1953. I found a few parallels between this story and some modern problems we have, but I'll let you do that. When Gelson entered, he saw that the rest of the Watchbird manufacturers were already present. There were six of them, not counting himself, and the room was blue with expensive cigar smoke. "Hi, Charlie," one of them called as he came in. The rest broke off conversation long enough to wave a casual greeting at him. As a Watchbird manufacturer, he was a member manufacturer of Salvation, he reminded himself wryly. Very exclusive. You must have a certified government contract if you want to save the human race. The government representative isn't here yet, one of the men told him. He's due any minute. We're getting the green light, another said. Fine. Gelson found a chair near the door and looked around the room. It was like a convention or a Boy Scout rally. The six men made up for their lack of numbers by sheer volume. The president of Southern Consolidated was talking at the top of his lungs about Watchbird's enormous durability. The two presidents he was talking at were grinning, nodding, one trying to interrupt with the results of a test he had run on Watchbird's resourcefulness, the other talking about the new recharging apparatus. The other three men were in their own little group, delivering what sounded like a panegyric to Watchbird. Gelson noted that all of them stood straight and tall, like the saviors they felt they were. He didn't find it funny. Up to a few days ago, he had felt that way himself. He had considered himself pot-bellied, slightly balding, saint. He sighed and lighted a cigarette. At the beginning of the project, he had been as enthusiastic as the others. He remembered saying to McIntyre, his chief engineer, "Mac, a new day is coming. Watchbird is the answer." And McIntyre had nodded very profoundly, another Watchbird convert. How wonderful it had seemed then. A simple, reliable answer to one of mankind's greatest problems, all wrapped and packaged in a pound of incorruptible metal, crystal, and plastics. Perhaps that was the very reason he was doubting it now. Gelson suspected that you don't solve human problems so easily. There had to be a catch somewhere. After all, murder was an old problem, and Watchbird too new a solution. Gentlemen? They had been talking so heatedly that they hadn't noticed the government representative entering. Now the room became quiet at once. Gentlemen, the plump government man said, the president, with the consent of Congress, has acted to form a Watchbird division for every city and town in the country. The men burst into a spontaneous shout of triumph. They're going to have their chance to save the world after all, Gelson thought, and worriedly asked himself what was wrong with that. He listened carefully as the government man outlined the distribution scheme. The country was to be divided into seven areas, each to be supplied and serviced by one manufacturer. This meant monopoly, of course, but a necessary one. Like the telephone service, it was in the public's best interests. You couldn't have competition in Watchbird service. Watchbird was for everyone. The president hopes, the representative continued, that full Watchbird service be installed in the shortest possible time. You will have top priorities on strategic metals, manpower, and so forth. Speaking for myself, the president of Southern Consolidated said, I expect to have the first batch of Watchbirds distributed within the week. Production is all set up. The rest of the men were equally ready. Factories had been prepared to roll out the Watchbirds for months now. The final standardized equipment had been agreed upon, and only the presidential go-ahead had been lacking. Fine, the representative said. If that is all, I think we can... Is there a question? Yes, sir, Gelson said. I want to know if the present model is the one we're going to manufacture. Of course, the representative said. It's the most advanced. I have an objection. Gelson stood up. His colleagues were glaring coldly at him. Obviously, he was delaying the advent of the Golden Age. What is your objection? The representative asked. First, let me say that I'm 100% in favor of a machine to stop murder. It's been needed for a long time. I object only to the Watchbird's learning circuits. They serve, in effect, to animate the machine and give it a pseudo-consciousness. I can't approve of that. But, Mr. Gelson, you yourself testified that the Watchbird would not be completely efficient unless such circuits were introduced. Without them, the Watchbirds could stop only an estimated 70% of murders. I know that, Gelson said, feeling extremely uncomfortable. I believe there might be a moral danger in allowing a machine to make decisions that are rightfully man's, he declared doggedly. Oh, come now, Gelson, one of the corporation presidents said. It's nothing of the sort. The Watchbird will only reinforce the decisions made by honest men from the beginning of time. I think that's true, the representative agreed. But I can understand how Mr. Gelson feels. It's sad that we must put a human problem into the hands of a machine. Sadder still, that we must have a machine enforce our laws. But I ask you to remember, Mr. Gelson, that there's no other possible way of stopping a murderer before he strikes. It would be unfair to the many innocent people killed every year if you're to restrict Watchbird on philosophical grounds. Don't you agree that I'm right? Yes, I suppose I do, Gelson said unhappily. He had told himself all that 1,000 times, but something still bothered him. Perhaps he would talk it over with McIntyre. As the conference broke up, a thought struck him. He grinned. A lot of policemen were going to be out of work. Now, what do you think of that? Officer Keltrix demanded. 15 years in homicide and a machine is replacing me. He wiped a large red hand across his forehead and leaned against the captain's desk. Ain't science marvelous? Two other policemen, late of homicide, nodded glumly. Don't worry about it, the captain said. We'll find a home for you in Larceny, Keltrix. You'll like it here. I just can't get over it, Keltrix complained. A lousy little piece of tin and glass is going to solve all the crimes. Not quite, the captain said. Watchbirds are supposed to prevent the crimes before they happen. Then how they'll be crimes? One of the policemen asked. I mean, they can't hang you for murder until you commit one, can they? That's not the idea, the captain said. The watchbirds are supposed to stop a man before he commits a murder. Then no one arrests him? Keltrix asked. I don't know how they're going to work that out, the captain admitted. The men were silent for a while. The captain yawned and examined his watch. The thing I don't understand, Keltrix said, still leaning on the captain's desk. It's just, how do they do it? How did it start, captain? The captain studied Keltrick's face for possible irony. After all, Watchbird had been in the papers for months. But then he remembered that Keltrix, like his sidekicks, rarely bothered to turn past the sports pages. Well, the captain said, trying to remember what he had read in the Sunday supplements. These scientists were working on criminology. They were studying murderers to find out what made them tick. So they found that murderers throw out a different sort of brainwave from ordinary people. And their glands act funny too. All this happens when they're about to commit a murder. So these scientists worked out a special machine to flash red or something when these brainwaves turned on. Scientists, Keltrick said bitterly. Well, after the scientists had this machine, they didn't know what to do with it. It was too big to move around, and murderers didn't drop in often enough to make it flash. So they built it into a smaller unit and tried it out in a few police stations. I think they tried one upstate, but it didn't work so good. You couldn't get to the crime in time. That's why they built the watchbirds. I don't think they'll stop no criminals, one of the policemen insisted. They sure will. I read the test results. They can smell him out before he commits a crime. And when they reach him, they give him a powerful shock or something. It'll stop him. You're closing up homicide, Captain? Keltrix asked. Nope, the captain said. I'm leaving a skeleton crew in until we see how these birds do. Ha, Keltrix said. Skeleton crew. That's funny. Sure, the captain said. Anyhow, I'm going to leave some men on. It seems the birds don't stop all murders. Why not? Some murderers don't have these brainwaves, the captain answered, trying to remember what the newspaper article had said. Or their glands don't work or something. Which ones don't they stop? Keltrix asked, with professional curiosity. I don't know, but I hear they got the damn things fixed, so they're going to stop all of them soon. How are they working that? They learn. The watchbirds, I mean. Just like people. You kidding me? Nope. Well, Keltrick said, I think I'll just keep old Betsy oiled, just in case. You can't trust these scientists. Right. Birds, Keltrick scoffed. Over the town, the watchbird soared in a long, lazy curve. Its aluminum hide glistened in the morning sun, and dots of light danced on its stiff wings. Silently, it flew. Silently, but with all senses functioning. Built-in kinesthetics told the watchbird where it was and held it in a long search curve. Its eyes and ears operated as one unit, searching, seeking. And then something happened. The watchbird's electronically fast reflexes picked up on the edge of a sensation. The correlation center tested it, matching it with electrical and chemical data in its memory files. A relay tripped. Down the watchbird spiraled, coming in on the increasingly strong sensation. It smelled the outpouring of certain glands, tasted a deviant brainwave. Fully alerted and armed, it spun and banked in the bright morning sunlight. Denali was so intent, he didn't see the watchbird coming. He had his gun poised, and his eyes pleaded with the big grocer. "Don't come no closer." "You lousy little punk," the grocer said, and took another step forward. "Rob me? I'll break every bone in your puny body." The grocer, too stupid or too courageous to understand the threat of the gun, advanced on the little thief. "All right," Denali said, in a thorough state of panic. "All right, sucker, take..." A bolt of electricity knocked him on his back. The gun went off, smashing a breakfast food display. "What in hell?" the grocer asked, staring at the stunned thief. And then he saw a flash of silver wings. "Well, I'm really damned. Those watchbirds work." He stared until the wings disappeared in the sky. Then he telephoned the police. The watchbird returned to his search curve. His thinking center correlated the new facts he had learned about murder. Several of these he hadn't known before. This new information was simultaneously flashed to all the other watchbirds, and their information was flashed back to him. New information, methods, definitions were constantly passing between them. Now that the watchbirds were rolling off the assembly line in a steady stream, Gelson allowed himself to relax. A loud, contented hum filled his plant. Orders were being filled on time, with top priorities given to the biggest cities in his area, and working down to the smallest towns. "All smooth, Chief," McIntyre said, coming in the door. He had just completed a routine inspection. "Fine. Have a seat." The big engineer sat down and lighted a cigarette. "We've been working on this for some time," Gelson said, when he couldn't think of anything else. "We sure have," McIntyre agreed. He leaned back and inhaled deeply. He had been one of the consulting engineers on the original Watchbird. That was 6 years back. He had been working for Gelson ever since, and the men had become good friends. "The thing I wanted to ask you was this." Gelson paused. He couldn't think how to phrase what he wanted. Instead, he asked, "What do you think of the Watchbirds, Matt?" "Who, me?" The engineer grinned nervously. He had been eating, drinking, and sleeping Watchbird ever since its inception. He had never found it necessary to have an attitude. "Why, I think it's great." "I don't mean that," Gelson said. He realized that what he wanted was to have someone understand his point of view. "I mean, do you figure there might be some danger in machine thinking?" "I don't think so, Chief. Why do you ask?" "Look, I'm no scientist or engineer. I've just handled cost and production and let you boys worry about how, but as a layman, Watchbird is starting to frighten me. No reason for that. I don't like the idea of the learning circuits." "But why not?" Then McIntyre grinned again. "Oh, I know. You're like a lot of people, Chief. Afraid your machines are going to wake up and say, 'What are we doing here? Let's go out and rule the world.'" "Is that it?" "Maybe something like that," Gelson admitted. "No chance of it," McIntyre said. "The Watchbird's all complex, I admit. But an MIT calculator is a whole lot more complex, and it hasn't got consciousness." "No, but the Watchbirds can learn." "Sure, so can all the new calculators. Do you think they'll team up with the Watchbirds?" Gelson felt annoyed at McIntyre, and even more annoyed at himself for being ridiculous. "It's a fact that the Watchbirds can put their learning into action. No one's monitoring them." "So that's the trouble," McIntyre said. "I've been thinking of getting out of Watchbird." Gelson hadn't realized it until that moment. "Look, Chief," McIntyre said. "Will you take an engineer's word on this?" "Let's hear it." "The Watchbirds are no more dangerous than an automobile, an IBM calculator, or a thermometer. They have no more consciousness or volition than those things. The Watchbirds are built to respond to certain stimuli, to carry out certain operations when they receive that stimuli." "And the learning circuits?" "You have to have those," McIntyre said patiently, as though explaining the whole thing to a 10-year-old. "The purpose of the Watchbird is to frustrate all murder attempts, right? Well, only certain murderers give out these stimuli. In order to stop all of them, the Watchbird has to search out new definitions of murder and correlate them with what it already knows." "I think it's inhuman," Gelson said. "That's the best thing about it," The watchbirds are unemotional. Their reasoning is non-anthropomorphic. You can't bribe them or drug them, so you shouldn't fear them either. The intercom on Gelson's desk buzzed. He ignored it. I know all this, Gelson said, but still sometimes I feel like the man who invented dynamite. He thought it would only be used for blowing up tree stumps. You didn't invent watchbird. I still feel morally responsible because I manufacture them. The intercom buzzed again, and Gelson irritably punched a button. The reports are in on the first week of watchbird operation, the secretary told him. How do they look? Wonderful, sir. Send them in 15 minutes. Gelson switched the intercom off and turned back to McIntyre, who was cleaning his fingernails with a wooden match. Don't you think that this represents a trend in human thinking? The mechanical god? The electronic father? Chief, McIntyre said, I think you should study watchbird more closely. Do you know what's built into the circuits? Only generally. First, there's a purpose, which is to stop living organisms from committing murder. Two, murder may be defined as an act of violence, consisting of breaking, mangling, maltreating, or otherwise stopping the functions of a living organism by a living organism. Three, most murderers are detectable by certain chemical and electrical changes. McIntyre paused to light another cigarette. Those conditions take care of the routine functions. Then, for the learning circuits, there are two more conditions. Four, there are some living organisms who commit murder without the signs mentioned in three. Five, these can be detected by data applicable to condition two. I see, Gelson said. You realize how foolproof it is? I suppose so. Gelson hesitated for a moment. I guess that's all. Right, the engineer said, and left. Gelson thought for a few moments. There couldn't be anything wrong with the watchbirds. Send in the reports, he said into the intercom. High above the lighted buildings of the city, the watchbird soared. It was dark, but in the distance the watchbird could see another, and another beyond that, for this was a large city. To prevent murder, there was more to watch for now. New information had crossed the invisible network that connected all watchbirds. New data, new ways of detecting the violence of murder. There, the edge of a sensation. Two watchbirds dipped simultaneously. One had received the scent a fraction of a second before the other. Continued down while the other resumed monitoring. Condition 4. There are some living organisms who commit murder without the signs mentioned in Condition 3. Through his new information, the watchbird knew by extrapolation this organism was bent on murder, even though the characteristic chemical and electrical smells were absent. The watchbird, all senses acute, closed in on the organism. He found what he wanted and dived. Roger Greco leaned against a building, his hands in his pockets. In his left hand was the cool butt of a .45. Greco waited patiently. He wasn't thinking of anything in particular, just relaxing against a building, waiting for a man. Greco didn't know why the man was to be killed. He didn't care. Greco's lack of curiosity was part of his value. The other part was his skill. One bullet, neatly placed in the head of a man he didn't know. Didn't excite him or sicken him. It was a job, just like anything else. You killed a man. So? As Greco's victim stepped out of a building, Greco lifted the .45 out of his pocket. He released the safety and braced the gun with his right hand. He still wasn't thinking of anything as he took aim and was knocked off his feet. Greco thought he'd been shot. He struggled up again, looked around, and sighted foggily on his victim. Again, he was knocked down. This time, he lay on the ground, trying to draw a bead. He never thought of stopping, for Greco was a craftsman. With the next blow, everything went black. Permanently. Because the watchbird's duty was to protect the object of violence, at whatever cost to the murderer. The victim walked to his car. He hadn't noticed anything unusual. Everything had happened in silence. Gelson was feeling pretty good. The watchbirds had been operating perfectly. Crimes of violence had been cut in half and cut again. Dark alleys were no longer mouths of horror. Parks and playgrounds were not places to shun after dusk. Of course, there were still robberies. petty thievery flourished in embezzlement, larceny, forgery, and 100 other crimes. But that wasn't so important. You could regain lost money, never a lost life. Gelson was ready to admit that he had been wrong about the watchbirds. They were doing a job that humans had been unable to accomplish. The first hint of something wrong came that morning. McIntyre came into his office. He stood silently in front of Gelson's desk, looking annoyed and a little embarrassed. "What's the matter, Mac?" Gelson asked. "One of the watchbirds went to work on a slaughterhouse man. Knocked him out." Gelson thought about it for a moment. "Yes, the watchbirds would do that. Their new learning circuits, they'd probably defined the killing of animals as murder." "Tell the packers to mechanize their slaughtering," Gelson said. "I never liked that business myself." "All right," McIntyre said. He pursed his lips, then shrugged his shoulders and left. Gelson stood beside his desk, thinking. Couldn't the watchbirds differentiate between a murderer and a man engaged in a legitimate profession? No, evidently not. To them, murder was murder. No exceptions. He frowned. That might take a little ironing out in the circuits, but not too much, he decided hastily. Just make them a little more discriminating. He sat down again and buried himself in paperwork, trying to avoid the edge of an old fear. They strapped the prisoner into the chair and fitted the electrode to his leg.
Oh,
he moaned, only half conscious now of what they were doing. They fitted the helmet over his shaved head and tightened the last straps. He continued to moan softly. And then the watchbird swept in. How he had come, no one knew. Prisons are large and strong with many locked doors, but the watchbird was there to stop a murder. "Get that thing out of here," the warden shouted and reached for the switch. The watchbird knocked him down. "Stop that," a guard screamed and grabbed for the switch himself. He was knocked to the floor beside the warden.
This isn't murder, you idiot,"
another guard said. He drew his gun to shoot down the glittering, wheeling metal bird. Anticipating, the watchbird smashed him back against the wall. There was silence in the room. After a while, the man in the helmet started to giggle. Then he stopped. The watchbird stood on guard, fluttering in midair, making sure no murder was done. New data flashed along the watchbird network. Unmonitored, independent, the thousands of watchbirds received and acted upon it. The breaking, mangling, or otherwise stopping the functions of a living organism by a living organism. New acts to stop.
"Damn you, get going,"
Farmer Ollister shouted and raised his whip again. The horse balked, and the wagon rattled and shook as he edged sideways.
"You lousy hunk of pig meal, get going,"
the farmer yelled, and he raised the whip again. It never fell. An alert watchbird, sensing violence, had knocked him out of his seat. A living organism. What is a living organism? The watchbirds extended their definitions as they became aware of more facts. And of course, this gave them more work. The deer was just visible at the edge of the woods. The hunter raised his rifle and took careful aim. He didn't have time to shoot. With his free hand, Gelson mopped perspiration from his face. "All right," he said into the telephone. He listened to the stream of vituperation from the other end, then replaced the receiver gently in its cradle. "What was that one?" McIntyre asked. He was unshaven, tie loose, shirt unbuttoned. "Another fisherman," Gelson said. "Seems the watchbirds won't let him fish, even though his family is starving." "What are we going to do about it? He wants to know." "How many hundred is that?"
"I don't know. I haven't opened the mail."
"Well, I figured out where the trouble is," McIntyre said gloomily, with the air of a man who knows just how he blew up the earth, after it was too late. "Let's hear it. Everybody took it for granted that we wanted all murder stopped. We figured the watchbirds would think as we do. We ought to have qualified the conditions." "I've got an idea," Kelson said, "that we'd have to know just why and what murder is before we could qualify the conditions properly. And if we knew that, we wouldn't need the watchbirds." Oh, I don't know about that. They just have to be told that some things which look like murder are not murder. But why should they stop fishermen? Kelson asked. Why shouldn't they? Fish and animals are living organisms. You just don't think that killing them is murder. The telephone rang. Kelson glared at it and punched the intercom. I told you, no more calls, no matter what. This is from Washington, his secretary said. I thought you'd... Sorry. Kelson picked up the telephone. Yes, certainly is a mess. Have they? All right, I certainly will. He put down the telephone. Short and sweet.